Welcome, everybody, to The Rad Life, the only talk radio show that takes you along with host and age explorer Rod Gontos on his continuing journey of discovery into life's challenges, opportunities, options, and all the latest and greatest things that come with getting older. The Rad Life is brought to you this week by Your Home for a Lifetime, a company dedicated to empowering you to stay safely, independently, and comfortably in your own home. And now here is your host, Rad Gontos.
Good afternoon, Paul.
Good afternoon.
How are you after this California primary?
Does that mean that we're in the secondary part now? This is the real main part, the primary
is
over.
What is this, an Italian restaurant?
Now we're just into secondary.
Primo and the segundo now?
That's right.
We're just the second course. You know what? The way stuff gets dished out, though, this year, I mean, who knows what the next thing we're going to get served is.
I said this earlier on our political show this morning. I'll say it again. The one thing that struck me was here we had a historic thing happen. A woman, for the first time, won a major party nomination,
yeah.
And nobody but Hillary wanted to talk about it. Everybody wanted to talk about Bernie. They wanted to talk about Trump. They wanted to talk about other things. It was not covered in the way I thought it would be covered.
Well, it raises an interesting point. I know we got a different kind of show lined up, but
yeah.
I can't not say this. It was a historical thing, and either way you look at
whether
it.
Whether you like it or not.
Whether you like it or not, whether you got to have issues or not. And the interesting thing is how it's playing out even now. Right, even the day after, because people always focus on the day, but then I find very few people go, well, what happens the next morning?
Yeah,
right. Well, in most cases, if you win, then you're basically getting over a hangover. But
right.
You know, the thing about yesterday was, I agree with you completely on that. The other thing I think is in their rush to announce, the media actually did Hillary a disservice.
You think so? Some people think that they did her a solid because people just stayed home and said,
well,
oh, it's over.
Well, from that aspect, yes. But from the historical nature of the moment, they did her a disservice. Because what they did is they opted the news, right? And she couldn't really claim it when they did, right? And you could argue that, you know, it may have caused people to stay at home because of, well, what's the point?
Right.
And you may argue that maybe people actually got angry enough to show up. So it can go both ways, and it's going to be really interesting to see. Many people were at the edge of their seats, almost in tears. I had a lot of people that were Bernie Sanders supporters, including myself. I voted for Bernie.
Mm-hmm.
But the yesterday night,
you hippie, you.
A lot of people, hey, you know, I'm a wannabe. Remember,
I'm a
boomer wannabe, right? I'm not a hippie. I'm a hippie wannabe. But and I can recite lyrics from Aquarius, then like song Aquarius.
Oh.
What is it? Hair. I can. I a bunch of them.
Right. The age of Aquarius.
The age of Aquarius. I am Aquarian, so I felt I needed to.
I see.
It.
Okay.
Right. But it really is interesting. I did not, for a minute, think he was going to concede yesterday, because the guy is consistent.
Yeah,
he is consistent. For the last 30 years, he's been in politics.
He hasn't conceded.
He has been consistent. And you watch a play by play of him facing Alan Greenspan in 2003, and you watch him listening. And I went to two rallies. So I was a stone's throw away, basically, right? And you can tell a lot about somebody's.
And you didn't bring a mic and get him on the Rad Life here?
No, I shook his hand though. But the point I'm trying to make is this: is that this is a person who's been consistent.
I'll tell you how consistent. He goes on stage, and the first thing he does is raise his fist in the old Revolution.
Yes.
And he says, the revolution continues.
Yes.
And I thought, where have I seen this? I'm having a 60s flashback here. Oh, my goodness.
Right. And so I knew he wasn't going to concede.
Mm-hmm.
The interesting thing is what happens now with this, because somebody said it yesterday. I think it was Chris Matthews or something on MSNBC. And he said, you know, in the old Roman Empire, the person who basically came into Rome could not bring his army with him.
Yes, right.
And basically yesterday in Santa Monica, when he was standing there, they basically said, well, he brought his army to Santa Monica, right? So what happens to that army?
Exactly. Does he tell them to go home, mission accomplished? Did he tell them we lost, but we'll get them next time? And the question is, did Bernie truly create a movement that will exist after his candidacy is over? Or did he just create a very passionate campaign?
Which is going to be interesting, right? Because this you can argue that we've kind of seen this before, but I don't think we've seen it with this generation.
I thought he would stand up. I was surprised. I thought he would stand up and say, look, you know, we gave it our best. the victory was not ours. But the fight continues, and we will, you know, the movement survives. It wasn't always about me. It's about a movement. It's about changing the world, and that will continue on, and I'll be here to lead that fight. And if you guys stay engaged, we'll continue to win more victories.
No way, because the words came out of his mouth on numerous occasions where he said, we're going to take this to the convention. But we're, I think, we're taking this to the convention.
I think he diminishes himself because he has created an aura of real. I'm real. I'm going to tell it the way it is. And he's not telling people. He's creating false hope for his followers that somehow the superdelegates are all going to swing his way and ignore the fact that she got 4 million more votes, one more states, including all the big states, and they got a 20-year relationship
with
her.
No, I think you heard a little bit of different tone yesterday night if you listened to his...
Slightly.
His,
right? He was a little.
Right?
Yeah.
Where he's already positioning, I think. Right? But the other thing, too, which is a reality... is that she's got a problem? She's got a problematic campaign in front of her,
and she needs him, and he recognizes that.
So it's going to be interesting whether the Democrats learn.
So what does he want? Huh? That's what nobody can figure out, and that's what everybody was amazed at.
So
hasn't
you
he already
always,
decided?
You always tell me, well, right. What the heck has this got to do with the show we're doing?
Yeah, what
okay.
the heck has
well,
this got to do with? The
I
show?
Already alluded to it with a little bit of the, you know, the, bringing your army into town and stuff like that, and then
okay.
what happens after the war is over, quote unquote, right? So see, I told you.
You're thinking now.
I had it lined up. So I've talked on this show. We've been doing this show for over a year.
I used to say to my wife, "I'm smarter than I look," and she'd look at me back. She'd say, "You have to be."
And here we go again with another therapy session for Paul.
Yeah, let's talk about that.
Yeah, no. You guys didn't know that this is pretty much Paul's therapy session.
That's
every
right.
week, right?
I work out issues
yeah.
on the show.
Yeah. So we've talked about this over and over a number of occasions. We've had people that were either involved in veteran services or people that were involved in nonprofits that serve as veterans or, you know, former veterans. Greg, council member Greg Rath from Mission Viejo was on the show a couple of times. And...
how did he do? I didn't see the result. Did he place in the top two?
No, he did not place in the top two. I think he was third, I want to say. But he ran a good campaign, and I reached out to him yesterday. A friend of mine who I know, Farah Khan, I should say, is in running for city council in Irvine.
Mm-hmm.
And we're lining her up for the show to be on the show in about a couple of weeks.
Okay.
Because there's actually, you're talking about the national arena of, you know, women, first nominee of a major party, da da da. There's actually very few, percentage wise, women in elected office. Period.
We've talked about that on numerous shows. They're underrepresented in a public office.
And this was part of the effort on Farah Khan's. Effort to go for a seat at City Council in Irvine is because they're trying to get more women to actually be in elected.
Go look at the site, realwomenrealsuccess.com. Realwomenrealsuccess.com. Lacey Shane, she used to run the ACCOC, Association of California Cities. She retired from that and now has this passionate project to try and recruit more women into public office. That's exactly what it's about. Yeah. They don't care what side, just get more women in the thing.
So I think that's going to play out big time. Now,
and Orange County is an unusual place because there are more female electeds in this county than another county.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that.
Yeah, if you look at the people like Diane Harkey and who's the other representative that used to be the city councilwoman, Pat Bates.
And then
we've had a couple city, I've forgotten her name, the Vietnamese city council or. County supervisor, and there's been a
Janet.
I don't know if it's Janet Wynn or the other one. Yeah. Anyway, there's been a succession of. There are quite a number of women that held either mayoral positions or higher positions in state government, federal government.
We've had women on city council in San Clemente as long as I've been there. Yeah. So it's something that I found
women have been
kind of strange.
Have been successful
that it's such a small percentage. You know, you're living in a microcosm. That's all you know. But then somebody opens your eyes because, well, actually, percentage wise, they're not as representative on elected seats.
Anyway. You might know this, which would be interesting as we transition into your guest now.
Yeah.
How that does that create a more are we going to use female stereotypes, a more nurturing view towards our veterans if you have more women, or is it more better to have male macho guys that have served?
I don't know if you recall, but during the interim election, what was it, 2 years ago, 3 years ago now, 2012 mm-hmm. or 14? Was it 14, 12? 12.
What year is
2012,
today?
2012.
What year are we in now?
There was a lot of women that were actually returning veterans that were running actually for Congress.
Yeah, Duckworth.
There was a whole bunch of them. So you raise an interesting point about that. It's the sort of the quasi stereotype. We mm-hmm. say, you know, the nurturing side, or what is it going to be? Mm-hmm. And to be honest, I think it's kind of exciting because I don't know that it's really definable anymore. You know, it's a lot of people were like, well, you know, why are you supporting Bernie? And, you know, if you don't support Hillary, then you're sort of, you know, against women being, I said, it's not the case. I said, I look at every candidate on their own merits. If you want to look at Hillary, my issues are not necessarily, gender is never a question here. Mm-hmm. The question is maybe judgment on certain things. And that aspect of it somehow also gets convoluted. So it's going to be interesting to, with the younger generation.
We're not going to start judging these people on the question of judgment, are you? People like Trump and Hillary, throw that measure out.
I tell you? I'm an idealist. I actually believe that if I'm going to vote for somebody, I want to vote for somebody I feel that can maybe do something other than just fill a seat.
No.
Okay?
It's who can yell at the other one the loudest.
Well, you're going to get a lot of yelling this year. I can guarantee you that. So I'll bring the popcorn.
Okay.
So let's talk about this because these movements, these activities, these actions, this is one form of sort of civil army, right? Yes. And we are coming out of transitioning out of, you know, a decade plus of being at war overseas.
Yeah.
And we've talked on this show about the fact that veterans, and it's no longer just, oh, you know, Vietnam vets or people from World War II. This is young people that went and served multiple tours in Afghanistan or Iraq that are coming back that are really not getting the support that they need in a meaningful way to transition, to give back. And one of the things we've talked about on the show, and this is the first show that we do, is we're going to take 1 hour every month out of the four shows that we do. So one show every month, and we're going to do a Veterans Hour.
Hooray. Long overdue. Let's talk about these issues.
Okay. And so in order to do that, today I reached...
Because they used to think veterans' issues were old folks' issues.
Well, that's what I mean.
The old veteran from World War One or Two or Korea or whatever, Vietnam.
Right.
Now it's because we've been in active combat for so long, far longer than anybody anticipated, quite frankly, I think at any level. We're having quite a number.
Well, we didn't have an exit strategy for our engagement, let alone, you know, what do we do with basically when people come back?
No.
And I think you and I have talked about sort of commonalities with how the Vietnam vets, when they came back, and how they basically were kind of not really treated well.
Spit upon.
It's not that way, but again, the service support we think you should have because of having learned that lesson is not here.
Yeah.
So I wanted to purposely actually reach beyond what you would call, you know, sort of the old school way of looking at a veteran. I didn't want to bring in people that were, you know,
Civil War veterans.
Right? I wanted to really talk about this from a different perspective as a first show that we do on this. And so I reached out to my buddy here sitting across the table from me, Moses Maddox, who is basically, I'm going to let him introduce himself, because these are issues that impact young people in America.
Yeah.
These are issues of transitioning into productive life, of being of service in a different way, and making sure that people don't fall through the cracks in the course of doing that. And it's not as simple as many people think.
No.
There's a lot that goes into it. So, Moses, I'm glad to have you on the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And sorry for the little dog and pony show that I did with Paul, but that kind of tends to happen. But would you please introduce yourself to our audience and give a little background on yourself?
Well, my background is I joined the Marine Corps at 17 years old. I joined way back in 99, before all of this was happening. So back in 99, it was just a job. I think the biggest thing...
So why did you join?
I wanted to get out of Texas.
Wanted to get out of Dodge.
Yeah, it just... I mean, I'm pretty sure...
We're going to have to coin that.
Yeah, I just need to get out of Texas. I saw the globe. I was looking at a globe one day, and I just saw how big it was, and I literally have only seen Texas. And, you know, when you take the size of the globe and figure out where Texas is, it's
Texas is pretty big, though, on the globe there. It takes up probably about 3/4 of the
especially
globe.
Especially if the globe is made in Texas.
I know. It's Texans think that Texas takes up 3/4 of the globe.
Here's the globe. Texas is this big. Right. The rest of the world is this big.
Yeah, it's like Texas and then California, and then I think that's it.
There's a little couple of other specs.
I don't think they call it California, though.
They call it some things. They call New Yorkers place. Very – they have certain verbs for or nouns for New Yorkers and Californians that we can't mention on public radio. Right. But I just really wanted to explore the world. Plus, I had broken up with a girl, and it was just
– I knew there was a girl
there. Yeah, it's like it was over, and I was like, I'll show you. I'll go to war. I'll go join the Marine Corps.
Yeah.
And I chose the Marine the day I decided to join
whose emblem ironically has a globe on it.
Yes.
Okay.
Awesome. But I chose the Marine Corps because the day that I decided that I wanted to join, he was literally the only recruiter there. That was how
Marketing 101. He's the only one.
Yeah, he was the only one there, so I chose him. It could have been the Coast Guard, and I would have joined the Coast Guard at that day.
How funny.
And I joined to be an aviation electrician.
Yeah.
And you need to be good at math, which I have a long, illustrious history with math as far as failing it.
Yeah.
So
how did that process? Can you walk me through that process? You show up. You're gonna enlist.
Yeah, you enlist.
The only person there is from the Marine Corps.
So you enlist.
How do you pick that?
Right, and so you enlist, and then you take the ASVAB. So they send you to MEPS, and then you got to do a series of physical exams, and they make you do the ASVAB, which is a test, the entry test.
Okay.
And I scored really, really high.
Do you do that in person? Do you do it online?
You do it in person. Remember, this is 99, so it was like everything was like.
Does it happen online these days?
I don't know what they do anymore.
Right.
But I remember in 99, the biggest thing was the 56K modem. That was a game changer, right?
Yeah.
56K. And then I leave
you
for
got
boot camp,
mail.
Right? I leave for boot camp, and then I come back, and all of a sudden they have cable modems and DSL. I mean, it was like
world changed. Yeah.
The world changed when I was gone.
Wow.
But I scored really high.
Not in Texas anymore.
You're right, exactly. I scored really high on the ASVAB, so I could have chosen anything. So I had a really good recruiter there, and he had his eye on the prize. He was like, "You need to choose a job that you can do outside of the military." Like, no matter if
how cool from that point.
Right. And so no matter if you do 4 years or 20 years or 30, you're going to get out.
Yeah.
So do something that translates well. So aviation electrician seemed like a really, really
good
idea.
Don't be an artillery or something. You're going to come out and say, well, now what do I do?
Exactly. Yeah. And we'll get to that in a second as far as, like, translating military skills. So I go to boot camp. I get out of school. I get out of boot camp. I go to the school. And you basically have to learn everything up to calculus in about 3 weeks.
Wow.
I mean, it is some high-level math you do with the aviation electrician. I could barely add 1 + 1 without using a calculator, so I was kicked out of that school. And whenever you sign a contract, you do sign for a specific job.
Right.
And then if you're not able to complete that job, then you are subjected to the needs of the Marine Corps.
Interesting.
And the needs of the Marine Corps at that time was financial management. So they took
financial manager. You know, we really need.
You failed math. But we're going to put you in charge of the money.
So I'm pretty sure I added to the deficit with the lack of transparency and budgetary things.
But
I mean,
you know, that's what I always think about. I think of the Marines charging up the hill, and they're like, "Where's our payroll?" You know, this is not what you anticipate.
I remember in Iraq, the longest days for dispersers were the 1st and 15th, because that's when that's when they would come get their money.
Wow.
You get reassigned, basically.
I get reassigned. So everything was normal until 9/11. I remember it being a Tuesday morning. You know, we were at something at 06, and everything came to a stop. And, you know, I can't say the word here, but Master came out and said, it's going down.
The doo-doo has hit the fan.
Yeah, the doo-doo has, you know, doo-doo has gone down, and we need to be here for this. And so we had several people from New York in our platoon.
And you didn't say, well, wait a minute, I didn't sign up for this.
It was more like it was just the mood changed almost immediately. Yeah. Like, the entire base is locked down. You weren't even allowed to come in or get out. When I did see the entry to camp, I was at Camp Pendleton. When you saw the entry, they had a tank, and they had a tank mounted with the 50 cal. And everybody was fully loaded. I mean,
I remember.
And I remember going through emergency training for MP training because they needed people to man the gates.
Well, it was like after the attack on Pearl Harbor. You know, where's going to be next? Where's the next plane coming?
Exactly.
You know?
Right.
Yeah, I remember. I was in San Clemente at the time.
Yeah, I mean, the mood changed. Mm-hmm. Like, there was a visceral change
I remember
in the entire mood of Southern California.
A couple people I knew, and I heard this happen a lot, were in New York at the time and on business. And their only impulse was to get home because nobody knew what was coming next. And the rental car, they ran out of rental cars. And, I mean, you couldn't get on planes because all the planes were grounded suddenly. And everybody went to grab a rental car. Mm-hmm. And I knew somebody who actually grabbed a rental car, got one of the last ones on, and just literally drove all night to get back to San Diego. Because it was that kind of feeling, mm-hmm. for those of you that weren't there at that horrendous moment. We didn't know what was coming next. We'd never been this kind of shocked.
So but also imagine the families. So we had several people from New York, and, I mean, we cleared the phone lines. If you had a cell phone, you're donating your cell phone. You're calling because the phone lines were down.
Yeah.
And, I mean, we did have people who lost family members on that day. And the mood changed. And so it became another needs of the Marine Corps. I didn't get to go with the original wave. I went in 2004. And I get credit for volunteering for this unit, but I was definitely voluntold.
voluntold, I like that
term. And so I joined a mortuary affairs unit, and that's how I deployed. Now, mortuary affairs, we were in charge of setting up the very first active duty mortuary affairs unit in the Marine Corps. So
you set up mortuaries in the Marine Corps?
Yeah, so...
You collected all the dead bodies?
Let me ask you a question, though.
Wow.
Okay, so did you... asked to be assigned to that, or did you get assigned to that? Because, I mean...
It was kind of all or nothing. The end of my contract was coming up, and we had done so much combat training. And remember, Marines want to go. Marines are specifically trained to go to war and crave it and want to go out there.
Well, I don't know if it's okay to ask, but how come only till 2004?
Just the needs of Marine Corps. Right. And so whenever I wanted to go, and it was like, well, the only way you can go is if you do this unit. That was it. Like, either you go and extend your contract or you get out, you never do this. So I went. I just couldn't be in the Marine Corps at that time and not go.
Not be engaged.
And I got really, there are some things, and it's kind of morbid, but I got introduced to where the priorities of the Marine Corps lie. So my unit, what we're in charge of is going to pick up our fallen brothers and brothers and sisters in battle. Mm-hmm. So whenever the area of operation was too high, like there's too much gunfire, if it's too dangerous for a helicopter to land and do a medevac, they would send us. So what that means is that $40 million piece of equipment was worth
more valuable.
Was worth way more than
we can get a bunch of Moses, but we need to keep that chopper flying.
We have 30,000 Moseses. We only have like two helicopters.
Wow.
And but it was on the job training. It was straight up OJT.
Yeah, I would think
like,
so.
OJT. There was
job training.
A lot of the people that I was with had never seen a body before. They have never, smelled death or what it meant. Or we had this like Hollywood version of what it meant to die.
Yeah, right.
And it's not that, it's graphic and it's horrible.
Yeah, your head comes off.
I couldn't eat fajitas for like years afterwards.
Oh,
and,
my God.
These are things that are just seared into your mind. And whenever I got out twice, mm-hmm. once in 2000, after my deployment in 2004, my contract is up. And there was no counseling. It was like, hey, you need to check out and thanks for your service. Like I was, basically came home from my first deployment to Iraq and was sent home.
And that was 2001.
Having picked up dead bodies for an assignment.
I mean, we sent in counselors to schools.
Yeah.
When we have shootings in this country.
Right.
Let alone actually go just clear the field of dead bodies.
Yeah. Right. We were on our own. And remember, in 2004, PTSD wasn't even the conversation.
Yeah, yeah.
Right. Even when I started college in 2008, PTSD was still an automatic crazy sentence. Mm-hmm. I remember getting out in 2006, and we'll talk about that in a second, and getting the pamphlets for PTSD, and then reading the newspapers about people who were diagnosed with PTSD, and I didn't want to be the crazy person. Because if you said, hey, I can't sleep or something like that. I mean,
you got mental issues.
You have mental issues, and all of a sudden, people don't want to hire you. You get stereotyped as something that you're not. All of a sudden, you're the broken veteran.
Mm-hmm.
And even Marines and active duty military members, we're very familiar with the stereotype of the broken Vietnam vet, right? Like, I mean, there's an entire library of movies about the broken vet.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
They came through the 70s and 80s.
Born on the 4th of July, all those
right, the Tom Cruise classic. I mean, that was a great movie, by the way. But, I'm not Tom Cruise from 4th of July. I mean, really, it boiled down to a lot of things happen over there really fast.
But it's interesting because here's you can't even ask for help. in a way that may basically reflect negatively on you, given what the common thought is about it.
Right.
Because it's going now all of a sudden you have even more to deal with.
Exactly. And on top of that, getting out from the Marine Corps in 2004, and I just wanted to get out of Southern California, so I moved to Phoenix, which was a horrible move on my end. Not because of the move, but there was a support system here in Southern California that just didn't exist in Phoenix at the time. And so I went from, you know, being supported, being around my brothers in the Marine Corps, having access to three different VAs, to going to Phoenix where the veteran support, while they love veterans, it isn't, you know, we've heard the
you
story.
Just assumed that it would be the same.
Right. Well,
there aren't a lot of military bases and whatnot. I mean, you've got a much higher concentration of military.
And let's talk about the, you know, the stories about the VA in Phoenix and how, like, they've been straight up killing people. You know, like,
yeah, isn't that the one that started the scandal where they were literally delaying? People were waiting so long to get care that they were dying.
Or they were killing themselves because they couldn't stand it anymore. Right. So that was what was going on in Phoenix, even in 2004.
You picked the right spot.
Yeah, nice VA to be in.
Right. Yeah. And so I got it picked up. And also, so there's that, right? I didn't want to be a mortician. And I was so far removed from actually doing financial management that I picked up the first job that I can get, which was at University of Phoenix. Now, University of Phoenix is a huge employer in Phoenix. Like, they are very...
Named the stadium after them, everything.
Right. Yeah. And it was funny because I made this joke. and I do... Sorry if I offend any UOP listeners. it was not surprising that the University of Phoenix Stadium played the wrong national anthem for Uruguay at the Copa America.
You understood.
Like, it was not like, what? Something stupid happened, and, you know, as a play, at a place, you know, associated with UOP, get out of here. And so
there's a huge UOP campus, by the way, just down the street from us here. So
I have stories. We have offline stories about that. But what I noticed is there was me, you know, I went from being in Iraq to working for University of Phoenix in a period of less than 2 months.
Right.
Like that. Let's talk. You know, that was crazy.
Right. How much time do you need to come back?
Well, we've talked about this before, right? Like back in the day, like World War II, at least, you would, or even with Vietnam, there was a period that you physically had to transition from a theater to actual back home.
Yes.
That you were on a boat, that you went through some sort of camaraderie and support system, intensive maybe for a period of whatever period of that time is, even with Vietnam, with the airlift kind of component, that was there.
Right.
Now,
and with air travel being what it is,
boom, 8 hours, you're back home. And
I mean, it was literally
20. Here's the keys to your car. Here's your.
Yeah.
In my second deployment, when I came home, three days before I came home, I had gotten in a firefight, and all of a sudden, I'm home. You know, like, we're hiking at Cabrillo National Monument, where, you know, 3 days before then, I was in Iraq. Like, and the thing is, like, you're expected to just pick up and go.
Yeah.
It's, you know, your time is done, time to move on. We're grown men. We have grown people, bills to pay. And...
get on with it.
Right. Move on. Like, you and it's almost, there was almost this sentiment of like, hey, you volunteered for this. You knew what you were getting into.
Yeah, we didn't we didn't force you to do this.
You didn't really.
Right. And so you hear these things, especially as a kid. I mean, I was like 26 at the time. Like, I didn't know any better. Like, I'm just kind of listening to the world around me and trying to act accordingly. You know, it's the reason why I have a job now is to prevent those kids. You know, there's still kids out there. Like, you don't realize how young. I didn't realize how young I was until I went back to Camp Pendleton. And I see these mountains of men and these really strong women with these baby faces. Like, I was like, there's some of them, like, have you even hit puberty yet, kid? Like, what are you doing? Like, you know, you just want to talk to them and pinch their cheeks because they're adorable. But these are young kids.
Which we don't see anymore past the uniform.
Right. I mean, these are kids, you know?
So what do you do now?
So I say all that, and I had some transitional issues, obviously. One, just with the PTSD, but two, just finding a job. So currently, I work as a veterans retention counselor.
What was the challenge, before you get there, what was the challenge with finding a job? Because we've touched on this lightly on the show before with some of our guests, but what was your personal experience with that?
So I have a very unique personal experience. So it's really unto me. So if people want to follow my career arc, just don't. don't. Yeah. And I'll tell you why. So when I first got it started in Palomar College in San Marcos, California in 2008, there was a veterans center, but no veterans organization. There was no veterans lounge.
Okay.
And I was asked to speak about veterans issues because I was one of the few people who were willing to say.
So there was a space, but there was nothing. No, but nothing happened. Like nobody managing it.
It was just we had one person, and she was kind of in charge of everything.
Okay.
And her primary function was GI Bill, like ensuring the veterans got their GI Bill on time. But schools and bureaucracies been what they were. They were just piling things on. So she couldn't handle the rest of it.
Got it.
Rightfully so. And so my introduction to the political world was saying that we need a lounge on campus. We need a place for veterans to come and be veterans.
Right.
Because I went to the VFWs and I was like, I'm not some dude who wants to freaking sit around at a bar and smoke cigarettes and drink beer and talk. You know, I love beer, but I don't smoke.
It's also speaking to that generational difference. I mean, you can't just lump everybody in the same mindset and profile.
Right. And I mean, so many veterans that we talk to, they want to be more than what they were while in the military.
Yeah.
We want to move on from this because it wasn't a happy experience.
Right.
Started a club on Palomar College. I ended up volunteering enough to where they started paying me to run the club. And I started lobbying for veterans issues on campus, which led me to lobbying veterans issues in San Diego, which led me to Sacramento, which led me to D.C. And in 2012, I introduced the GI Bill Consumer Awareness Act of 2012.
Fantastic.
And what that did was basically try to create a Yelp for higher ed.
Mm-hmm.
So if you and I were to go grab lunch, hey, let's go grab some sushi. We put on our phone and we figure out what the best sushi spots are.
Mm-hmm.
You can't do that for higher ed. And even the programs that are out there just aren't that good. Anyway, through that time period, through that experience, I got to appear on The Late Show with David Letterman. So I was a guest on The Late Show with David Letterman.
You can't be on The Rad Life, that's the next best.
Right. I mean, if you ever want...
Do we have interesting people on this show or what?
Yeah, I mean, if you ever want a career change, you know, get on
Letterman.
But the dirty little secret is that I had about 80... I put in my application about 80 different places in San Diego and only two callbacks. And one of those callbacks was Thanks But No Thanks.
Now,
this should speak to the power of networking.
Yeah.
I spent 10 minutes on The Late Show with Letterman and had 500 job offers all across the nation.
Wow. Wow.
And what's even crazier is many of those jobs weren't public. Right?
People saw you and they were moved.
Amazing.
And they said, I'll give this guy a job.
Right. They were just
amazing.
Like, and so that was my transition, was a lot of advocacy, but...
How did you get on David Letterman? How did that happen?
Was it because of your involvement in D.C.?
Yes, it was because of my involvement in D.C. I was on at this... I was doing the D.C. thing at the same time that Michelle Obama was unveiling her Veterans Initiative.
Sure.
David Letterman wanted to help out, and Michelle Obama said, hey, just have some guy. Like, don't have a general or... have some dude tell a story. And I just happened to be that dude. You know, for me, it was, you know, luck of the draw, basically. But also I see it as like a culmination of being involved for 4 years on a college campus, advocating for veterans. That was the highlight. That was the culmination of it all. What I learned, though, was there are transitional issues that need to be dealt with.
Okay.
There are. The first one is, as we're talking before the show went on, what is the role in the military in the veterans transition?
This was fascinating. I never looked at it from this perspective. Go ahead. I think this is a unique insight into what the problem is. We all sit back and say, well, what's wrong? We all honor veterans now. We don't spit on them like we did in the Vietnam era. We don't call them names or whatever. We all say we support them and embrace them, but...
Right, and we'll get to that in a second, too. But the role of the military is to win wars and defend the nation. That is their job, and they do it well.
Mm-hmm.
There is nothing in the military that says, hey, we need to help them quit their job.
Mm-hmm.
Like, once the contract is up, the contract is up.
Mm-hmm.
The military is obligated to you to provide certain things while you're on active duty. And while you're on active duty, you are obligated to serve the military in an honorable fashion. Once the contract is done, the contract is done. The job.
That's it. There's no transitioning out. There's no.
And so.
Because they're on to the next. All right, let's get the next recruit in. Let's go win the next conflict. Let's do this. Thanks for your service. And we'll hand you off to another agency created to supposedly help veterans affairs.
I keep looking at the clock only because I don't think we're going to take a break, but we've got about 15 minutes, 20 minutes, and I don't want to cut you short. So With these transition problems, and I mean, obviously we're not going to touch on all of them today.
Right.
All right. What has changed?
Well, the first thing that's changed is...
Or how have you been part of that change? What happened after Letterman?
Right. So I joined this organization called The Mission Continues. And this is why I started learning my chops about veterans transition issues. Mm-hmm. And the thing is that you talked about meaningful help. Right now, veterans are just drowning in a sea of goodwill. If you look up veterans organization, there's if you Google three veterans organizations right now, you'll see 300 million Google hits. Mm-hmm. There's about, like, I want to say close to like, I think like 100,000 different.
To Paul's point, we support the troops.
But, right, we support the heck out of the troops. But the problem is what is the meaningful help,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
And two, how are we preparing our troops for the real world?
Mm-hmm.
Now, especially in Southern California, it's a very competitive market,
mm-hmm.
right? We have people with master's degrees going in entry-level jobs because the market is saturated with people in higher ed.
Right.
We have some amazing institutions here. There's that level of support where I come in, helping the veteran understand their place in the market and how to make themselves marketable.
Okay, I'll tell
but
you.
But a lot of things have to go happen first before they get to me.
I'll tell you, Moses, how important that is. I remember having the lady here who, and I'm sorry I'm forgetting her name, but she runs Patriots in Pause.
Yes, I love her.
Okay, mm-hmm. And actually Greg Rath works with them, and he was here with her, I think, or we had him before, and she came here. And she brought in a veteran with her, and we were talking, and he was talking about that he can't really feel connected to somebody that's going to give him therapy or give him sort of that support because they don't have a commonality of experience.
They weren't in combat.
Right? And I looked over because we were starting to talk about GI Bill, and I said, okay, so it looks to me like you have a need to provide counseling and support services to veterans that potentially fellow veterans can be providing that are trained and licensed and experienced in particular fields.
Mm-hmm.
Is anybody making the connection for people to utilize and leverage the GI Bill towards something that isn't only beneficial to them, but that in the future could be beneficial to their
train
comrades
them to help others
in arms? And she said to me, well, in a lot of cases, they're just wanting to get their payments.
Yes.
Why they go to school.
But I'll tell you, because when I saw what you were doing, to me, it was almost like an answer to that question that I had asked. That there's somebody who's, you know, maybe there's an increased awareness slightly to try to channel that into something more meaningful.
Right.
And just the period of the GI Bill.
It goes to, so whenever you get to me at Cal State University San Marcos,
yeah.
whether you're a transfer student or the first year student, right? What I say is...
What's your team at San Marcos, by the way?
Say again?
What's the team at San Marcos?
The Cougars.
The Cougars. Okay.
Yeah, like it's like...
I don't know. I'm asking.
I think we just joined the NCAA, so I mean, we got a long way to go.
Okay.
So one of my messaging points, and we have a strong veterans team there, where the director of veterans will stand at orientation and say, if you're here just to receive payment, go somewhere else. If you want to waste your GI Bill, don't come here because we're not about that life. If you want to be successful, you come here. If you want to do something with your life, you come here and we will support you. So you're absolutely right. I've been dealing in higher ed since 2008, so there are a lot of people.
How long has this awareness been? It's relatively a new thing?
It's one of those...
Or where it's actually being put into place?
It's one of those worst, like one of those like dirty little secrets that no one talks about.
Uh-huh.
Because when you say that, hey, there's a lot of waste in the GI Bill,
uh-huh.
the first thing that happens is the governments want to cut it,
uh-huh.
which is already happening, right?
Right.
That's
unbelievable that they're cutting benefits.
The citizen in me is saying,
my return?
Where's the tangible data? I'm a taxpayer.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like if I'm going to give you $50,000 to $60,000 of education
benefits,
you best become a productive member of society.
I hear you.
That's from a taxpayer point of view, from a person who's been there, like who the heck are you to get a free ride?
Well, in some cases, especially in cases of universities that are basically, you know, pretty much by the degree,
mm-hmm.
you know, I'm sure a lot of veterans are looked at as being just cash cows. Excuse my French.
Well, they are.
Yeah.
So whenever
and isn't that true, particularly for these? This has been the complaint about these online schools. University of Phoenix, you mentioned, there's been two or three other big ones out, and some of them have had a lot of controversy, where this online score, where these accredited
universities... Trump University, no.
Right.
Well, you know, where these places were created, these for-profit institutions, and the profit pool are the veterans and the benefits that they get.
So I'm going to kick some knowledge real quick. So the Title IV funding rules that were applied in 1970. So this is how this governs the federal aid. So we're talking about Stafford loans, Pell grants, all that new stuff.
That's the Title IV.
That's Title IV funding for higher ed. Now, there's this thing called the 90-10 rule, which basically states the government will be more than happy to provide an institution 90% of its funds.
Okay.
Right? But 10%, your product has to be good enough where 10% of your funds have to come from cash.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So simple. Oversimplified, but accessible.
Yeah.
Now, what happened is with the post 9/11 GI Bill,
mm-hmm.
right? That's considered cash. It's not considered Title IV.
Oh.
So here's where it gets really interesting. So for every dollar, every single dollar, just for $1 of GI Bill funds, that means an institution gets $9 of federal funding.
Because they prove somebody's paying for this service.
Exactly.
But they're paying for it with public funds.
Right. So with someone like University of Phoenix, and we factor in the GI Bill payments.
That's why they named the stadium. No,
right. I mean, they're a multi-billion dollar industry.
Yeah.
A minor percentage of every single dollar spent actually goes towards education. Like, we could talk about this all day. But there is a loophole in which it is a cash grab.
Mm-hmm.
It is such a cash grab. And for a social program, that any social program, especially a government-funded program, needs to deliver results. The results aren't there.
Well, and what is the duration? I mean, is it for undergraduate? Is it for graduate?
So 36 months of benefit usage.
Okay.
All right. So as long as you're going to school and you certify that you're going to school for either quarter or for half time, three quarter time, or full time, you will get
benefits. You get a couple. What's an average benefit? A couple thousand dollars a month or something?
In where I live, it's about $2,200. I think here in Costa Mesa is pretty close to $2,700. And San Francisco.
But that's 3 years worth of benefits.
That's 3 years worth of benefits. So if you use it correctly,
mm-hmm.
like you can take this all the way to grad school
mm-hmm.
if you use it correctly. Mm-hmm. But a lot of people.
Assuming somebody's advising you to how to use
right.
it correctly.
Right. And also just.
But you're saying a lot of these people just do it just to get to $2,700. They flounder around. There's no real purpose to it. It's just to get the money.
I don't want to say a lot, but I do want to say.
There's a significant number that people
notice. There's a percentage out there that does. But for those who are actually pursuing for the right reasons,
mm-hmm.
just getting out of the military and going to school and getting your degree is not enough. So you have to look at this situation where you're in, where you have 4 years to position yourself for the post-graduation goal that you want, whether it be a career or education,
mm-hmm.
right? So what grad school do you want to go to?
Right.
Right. So what I say to my veterans.
In a way, it's counseling that, I mean, I remember when I went to grad school, right? The assumption was, oh, well, you'll figure it out. I was 20 years old. I could have really used some direction, but the assumption was you're in graduate school, you don't need direction. So it's not uncommon that you won't get it. And when you do get it, you benefit, whether you are a returning veteran, whether you're somebody else. So you know, if we offer this kind of counseling to somebody that's not a returning veteran,
right.
that doesn't have a problem in orienting themselves in an environment where everybody around them is pretty much, you know, either younger or that is perceived by them as being younger because they haven't seen maybe as much as they have. I read about a lot of reports where people that were going back to college with the GI Bill after Afghanistan and Iraq, they felt isolated.
Right.
That felt that, you know, they didn't, they would just sit in the, and kind of keep
by
to themselves.
Yeah.
That in some cases, because they were conditioned in the military to be problem solvers, they didn't even seek out assistance because it was just like, well, I'll just figure it out myself.
Right.
And but so, was still floundering and still not really kind of coming to terms with, I need help.
And I'm older than the other students. I've had a different life experience than they have. I've seen combat, whatnot. I can't relate to these kids.
And quite honestly, my response to that is get over it. Get over it. All right, so whenever you join the military, you're part of the 1%.
Right.
So you take the inverse relationship of that, right? You are now joining the 99%.
Right.
It is up to you to figure this out. It is up to you.
They're not going
to
change for you. You got to change for them.
Right.
It's 99% of
them. You know, I might be bad at math, but I can talk about inverse proportions pretty good.
You're still doing financial.
So yeah. With that being said, it is like you have to learn how to get along in this world.
Yeah.
And so part of that is getting involved in college campuses, learning how to bridge your own bridge. Now, my job, what I'm here to do is help to be that safety net. So if you do flop, my job is to ensure you don't flop too hard.
Well, and let's say this, Moses. Okay, when you say let's get over it, there's also a sense of support when you say that. I just want to stop back. You know, people in general, okay, benefit from guidance.
Right.
Okay. So sometimes the guidance is a little bit
hard-edged,
affronting, I should say, right? To get kind of like wake you up a little bit, get you out of the funk a little bit. But that is something that you are still providing, and I think it's wonderful that that is in place because everybody would benefit from that.
Right. It really is. Like, here is the market that which you want to exist in, right? So if you want a career in nonprofit or in corporations, right? The person in front of you, quite honestly, doesn't care if you were deployed one time, zero times. Right. The only question that they ask is, can you do the job and are your culture fit?
Actually, and I think we're going to have you come back, but the thing about it is most of those people that are going to be hiring you may actually not in their own minds connect how your skill set that you have developed or you've picked up can transition in what it is that they're looking for.
Right, but as in a world where everything is sales, and remember, this is America, so everything is business. The business of America is business.
True. Right?
Let's be real here. So
Calvin Coolidge said that.
Exactly. I got my history background. You're absolutely right. The hiring manager across from you may not know what you've done, but the onus is on you to convey.
Absolutely.
Like, to sell yourself. And so my job is to, one, connect that help that person identify what they really want to do. Mm-hmm. Like, when you do the research, veterans tend to go towards like 10 or 11 different things, right? It's like law enforcement or some sort of government job or nonprofit where they want to help other veterans. They don't even know what they don't know, that there's a big world out there. And there's literally a paying position for anything that you want to do.
Right.
The question is, do you have the wherewithal to go find it?
You might even not know what you want to do.
Right. I never imagined myself as a college counselor. I was a business major, and I switched my major once I discovered sociology. I had no clue that I would be on a college campus doing what I'm doing. But what I will say is that my job is to say those things, but also show them how they can not only exist in this world, but be successful. Because the dirty little secret is that what they're looking for is out there. And what they're looking for, people want to give that to them. Mm-hmm. But it's up to them to go take it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, this not
nobody's going to hand it to you. Nobody's going to. They might give you the benefit of the doubt and say, we're going to help you. We will see you. We'll respond to you. But if you don't step up and take it and sell them on it, then
and so
the onus falls on you.
So part of this is when I...
That's pretty hard talk for guys that went out and put their lives on the line for all of us. We come back and say, get over it and learn how to go sell yourself.
But also we want to be careful. Like, though I say get over it, right? It's in a more soft kind of way. But
And I think that's the trick, right? Or not the trick. That's really the core of this.
Yes.
The core of this is, how do you do that? It's not a matter of softening the message. It's how do you deliver the message.
Right. Yeah. So it's a focus on pure empowerment, right?
Yeah.
So whenever I sit down in front of a veteran, I do an assessment using Maslow's hierarchy of needs. So I won't even get in that.
But basically,
I'm an economics major.
Oh, awesome. So you know how that works. Yeah. And so it's really assessing them and saying, hey, based off our conversation, this is where I see you. Do you agree or disagree?
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
And we go back and forth. But essentially, everything that we do, whether it be the assessment through Maslow's hierarchy of needs, setting SMART goals, whether it be academic or professional, time management, networking, they do that. Mm-hmm. I have them write it down. I have them own it. Mm-hmm. So whenever they don't deliver, they're not failing my program. They're failing their own words. Like, this is what you said for yourself.
You bought into it.
Right. You bought into it. This is what you said for yourself, and you didn't achieve it. So the question is, how do we get you there?
Yeah.
So who do you
have with you in the studio? You brought somebody with you in the studio.
Somebody else is eager to speak here.
This is my sidekick. Kind of a backstory. My dad used to take me to work all the time. So
he worked in the
printing presses. So like, I could still run like an old school analog printing press. Like, that is ingrained in my head. I could work binder. So that was, he taught me an industry.
What were they, Heidelbergs or something?
Heidelbergs.
There you go.
Oh, man, you took it back.
You know my printing.
So my dad used to take me to work all the time, and I learned the industry through that.
Yeah,
and
my dad did the same thing.
And so I technically don't really, according to my father, I don't work because
my dad thinks the same thing.
I don't work, but I take my son to work with me as much as I can to show him that, you know, the world is out there for him to go get, but he needs to be comfortable in these scenarios.
Well, let him say hello.
So come
on
up. Let
him do a shout out to his buddies here, his girlfriend or whatever.
Hi, I'm Cesar. My dad's Moses Maddox. He takes me a lot to these events, and I see different aspects of the Veterans Association and stuff like that. One of the main things is that I've realized is a veteran can tell another veteran get over it, much like like whenever they're getting out of transition.
True. Yes.
But
he's not going to take it from me,
yeah,
but he'll take it from
yeah,
me.
A non-veteran can't say it. So someone like myself can't tell a veteran, even though I have experience working with veterans because of my father. Someone like me can't say to a war-torn veteran and stuff like that, get over it, because they will constantly go through, hey, you don't know what I did.
You don't know
blah,
what
blah,
it's
blah,
like,
blah.
Yeah.
Yeah, but... No, and
so
and
would
like,
you would you be a veteran? That's my curiosity. Listening to your dad's story, listening to the difficulties transitioning out of that world, would you ever consider going into the military?
I'm not entirely sure. I'm 14. I have my entire life to figure out. But like one thing, like whenever he was talking about his transition, I was able to see most of it. And like I remember whenever he first got into college, he wasn't there because of the two deployments and stuff like that. That's a little background thing. But whenever he first entered college, the entire, for our family, everything kind of changed from that. One, because we weren't used to having him around as much as he...
Right.
Yeah, we weren't used to having him around as much as he was. But,
and you raise an important point that I think a lot of people forget, is that these veterans that are coming back... There's a family structure, maybe. There's some sort of other aspects of life. Like I was reading about how some of the veterans are actually petitioning colleges to basically evaluate things like, and I don't know how you follow about this because you're kind of working at the college, at the university, but, you know, like give credits for honorable discharge. There's certain things that have value to basically equate with the educational path.
Well, here's what I would propose. Like, first, there are some rules out there. So in California,
don't ding me for not attending a class. I've got family. I've got this. Right. I got all this stuff.
You know, it is that.
Is it just California?
It is kind of California. Like every state is different. Actually, no. Like a lot of university systems don't give credit for military experience.
Yeah.
So I mean that's the lure of the for-profit world is right. Like if you're aviation electrician, you can go to Embry-Riddle, and most of your aviation electrician training will be credit.
Yeah.
Now, when you get that degree from Embry-Riddle and you try to go to, like, you know, UCR or UCI, then you're going to have to start from scratch because, they're not even going to recognize the degree.
Right, right.
But, you know, when we talk about the family dynamic, I mean, he's absolutely right. I wasn't really there. I was too busy playing Marine. And so when we talk about transition, you know, there's a transition of making really good money to not making really good money.
Yep.
There was a transition of being identified as a Marine, which the Marine Corps raised me from the ages of 17 to 26, right. Trying to figure out myself as a man.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the
Your
whole...
self-identity. That's who I am.
Yeah,
I'm
like,
a Marine.
I was Corporal Maddox, and now I'm Moses. Who the heck is that guy?
Yeah.
Right? Like, you know, I'm allowed to think my own thoughts, and, like, the thoughts that I were thinking were so diametrically opposed to what I was raised in.
So was that exciting, or was it scary?
Difficult.
It became exciting. It became, once I started kind of discovering myself and my thought process, and, you know, I credit liberal arts education for this, as far as like pushing me to explore my own thoughts and explore the roots of them, that it became exciting because it was fun arguing with myself.
And you said, yeah, I have the best discussions with myself too. But
you got to consult the experts, right?
Absolutely. You mentioned the word in passing, but I think it's a very important word, and we use this here all the time. It is an issue of empowerment,
right?
And it's a self empowerment thing,
right?
And if you can find that sweet spot of self empowerment and self challenging, which is what you were talking about too, by having them write it down, right? If you engage that in a positive way, then it is a change agent. It's a huge change agent,
right? The only thing I ever say is like as long as you and I are working together, there are no failures.
Right.
Like if you say you want a 3.0 this semester and you get a 2.8, you did not fail. The question is, how do we get you to that 3.0?
Mm-hmm.
The moment you fail is the moment you stop showing up.
Yeah.
Like, I think you've been in the game for, since St. Nick, apparently.
That's right. Way back.
And you've been in the game.
Back. That's what he does for Christmas. That's how it goes pleasant.
And there's several things that
I'm
are very...
I'm a gray beard here. Okay.
But one of the things that becomes so clearly evident is that 90% of the game is just showing up.
Mm-hmm.
Like, just showing up and busting your rear end while you're there. And good things tend to happen. And there's...
Luck comes from hard work and preparation.
Well, you know, the old saying, and it's kind of cliche a little bit, but, you know, what would you do today if you knew that you couldn't fail?
That's interesting.
What would you attempt today if you knew that you couldn't fail?
And I'm happy to say I'll be doing this.
Right.
Wow. You know, which is amazing, because that is where you want to be.
Right, because, me getting paid to do this job, I've already done it for free. I was a volunteer for 6 months before CSUSM started paying me. I was doing this for free.
Yeah.
And the only reason why I don't continue doing it for free is because he requires some sort of sustenance and medical.
Those kids.
You know.
Sorry?
Greedy. Greedy kids.
He actually pointed his finger at us.
No, really? Throw him under the bus. Thanks, man. Thanks, man. I appreciate it.
This is, we were at Soup Plantation this Sunday, and 2 hours later, we spent a good hour there, and he's just going at it.
Sucking it all
work.
Up.
Here, it was graphic. It was the eyes were in the back of his head. He was watching that. And then 2 hours later, hey man, I'm hungry again. I'm are you serious, dude?
Whenever you're 14,
your metabolism high.
Yeah. It was enjoy it, kid. Enjoy it. But when it comes to empowerment, it is, one, the person that is in the position to empower, mm-hmm. they have to understand the market that exists right now. So everything that I'm presenting right now is for the person to be successful in the market now.
You got to be real. What's the point of empowering them to be a pottery maker or something?
Well, it is to say that, all right, if you want to be a pottery maker, who are those guys making that pottery?
Yeah.
Right?
How are you going to live doing this?
Yeah. Right. And having those honest conversations. If you want to be in carpentry, why are you at Cal State San Marcos pursuing a business degree? Take your butt to Collamer College.
My wife is a director of admissions graduate college of education at Cal State Long Beach. And so there is a discussion taking place in higher education these days that maybe it's not higher education, maybe it's not for everybody. Maybe there is apprenticeship. Maybe there are things. To your point, if this is what you want to do, okay, then go do that. Go be the best at that and maybe think how you're going to get there. And if you're lucky, have somebody kind of maybe help you and guide you, whether it's an apprenticeship program, whatever. It's not always, doesn't always have to be in a classroom to find that thing
and
that you're passionate about.
And the flip side of that is we're convinced everybody has to go to college and come out with these degrees, and yet the jobs that are open right now, good paying jobs, air conditioning technicians, CNC operators, they are getting older and nobody's replacing because they're not cool and sexy jobs, even though you can get $100,000.
Exactly. I advise this one person to go. He got a 6-month certificate from a community college to be, and he's got a certified carpenter thing, and he's making $120,000. Building cabinets for this developer.
He
was like, dude, this is awesome. I only work 5 hours a day.
Whereas he could get a history degree and come out and struggle to get a $20,000 a year job.
Right. And it's not to say there's something wrong with academia, but I think to speak to your point, where I remember growing up in the 90s where that was in my head of
to have it.
Yeah, you go get your degree and there's basically a job waiting for you.
Yes, right.
And then when I joined the military, the talking point was, all right, cool. You go to the military, you get your degree, and you're basically employable everywhere for all the jobs offered.
Right. That's false. That's false as could be. Absolutely.
And maybe that was true in the 90s. Maybe that was true in the early 2000s. But something changed drastically after the crash of 2008, where even if the market has recovered,
you have people working longer, you have people retiring later, you have people healthier doing stuff.
Also, you look at the Bureau of Labor Statistics and you see the civilian job rate being at 3.3% and the veteran job rate being at 3.8%, which looks good. That's a great talking point for any politician who is responsible for that. But what we're not talking about is the underemployment.
Yeah.
The
people that are no longer being counted.
Right. The people are not being counted. But I think the bigger one is those who are working in positions just because they needed to start earning a paycheck. And so,
oh, you're employed. We're off the list.
Yeah, you're off the list. Congratulations. But what are you doing with 2 master's degrees only making $50,000 a year?
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
That's
or
not
flipping burgers.
Right. Or working, you need a bachelor's degree to work.
I had a lady that I know that was went through some medical issues. She got injured while she was doing Uber, but she used to work for doing fleet sales at car dealerships. She got a job. She went and worked at car dealerships. Because of the way that the payment structure was, she basically felt like she got screwed, excuse my French, and basically abandoned that and decided she was just going to basically Uber because she was making more money Ubering.
Right? Amazing.
So when we look at people and go, oh, well, you know, you're happy, you're doing something, you know, you're bringing money. It may not be where your passion or what you really want to do, but sometimes it's just what you have to do.
Got to.
Right.
Hey, well, you know what we got to do is we got to wrap up.
Oh,
man, this is fun.
I know.
We got to get him to come back. We already went over here.
Corporal Maddox or Moses? What do you want me to call you?
Call me Moses.
Moses, okay.
Yeah, I'm 10 years
removed. You're done with that? You're done with that?
Okay.
you had a glimmer in your eye when you said that a minute ago. So
it's more of a squint?
It was a squint?
All right, I did that.
I snapped it when you said it. Okay.
It was a clip. So, Moses, give people a little bit more information about where they can find, you know, about San Marcos, like give the website, and then how do they get hold of you? And then I do want to have you come back and talk more. This is our first hour that we've done on this, and as people can see, we easily ran over because this is a topic that isn't being talked about enough, especially from a position of empowerment.
No.
What we know about veterans and veterans benefits and issues based on what we may have seen in movies or, you know, whatever, born on the 4th of July, if you will, is not the reality we're living today, and especially not the one veterans
are. And I think the sad reality is what we hinted at. There is a lot of support for veterans. There is sympathy for veterans in this country today. And so they throw money at the situation and say, here, go get a GI Bill, go get education, fix it. And then we think it's done. We have fixed it.
But
we feel bad for you. We give you a bunch of money. Good. It's done.
But throwing money at the problem isn't actually doing anything. Like, there are many programs who have just tons of money to give away. But yet, they only have, like, three people actually trying to work on the project.
Yep.
No, like, not applying. Trying to, like, work on the project. I'm pretty sure many people would apply for that job.
If they knew it. Right. And then we're admitting that some people do it, and they don't really know what else to do, so they apply for the GI Bill.
But
they go to school just so they can get a couple more years.
We live in a society, Moses, I think, touched on it a little bit indirectly, but we live in a society where everything is likes. Okay, and shares. Okay, it's like, you know, like everybody. It's almost like a unconditioned response. Like, new thing, like something like monkey hitting the button, right?
I've done my bit. I liked it. I shared it. I'm done, right?
I'm out of it. But I will tell you what is interesting about that is it tells you that we are a society that is okay about showing our support by saying, "Oh, we support the troops,"
mm-hmm.
but where's the transition? Where's the traction? How does that transition, and how does it get transitioned efficiently to something that's really beneficial, other than on the surface being, "Oh yeah, well we're all for that."
Here, we'll throw some more money at it. There, it's done.
And I'm sorry, you know, I'll say this. I'm going to get on my soapbox just for a second, okay? But when you basically say you support the troops, and then you basically say we are not for affordable housing or transitional housing or things like that, where you basically, you know, some people that are struggling, that may be veterans that are homeless, when you basically, in your mind, equate that you support the troops, but you basically turn a blind eye when somebody is basically a veteran.
I support them, but somewhere else.
Like, first of all, I'm loving this show because there is this coherent dialogue that I think is missing. Like, you started off the show talking about the debates and everything like that. And the problem with, I think, there are many, but one of the things that really bugs me specifically is the lack of dialogue between the two parties.
Amen.
Where there's going to be a lot of yelling and screaming. And so, to go to your point, what I think it is people just don't know what they're saying when they say it. And you know, I
break. He's
it.
Good.
Yeah.
You know,
he just deflated my anger.
Right? Because, I mean, the thing is, like, when we just spent an hour here and we touched a bunch of things, but we didn't really focus on anything.
No.
Because the issue is.
See how
so
quick an hour goes?
Oh, I love it. I mean, I have a radio show down in San Diego, which I should get you on.
Yeah.
And
I would love to do that.
So, what it is these issues aren't hardly ever simple, but people want to put them in boxes because that's how we're built as human beings.
It's how we are as a society. Everything is a nice little box with a label on it, and I put it on the shelf.
Right, and honestly, society is lying to us.
Not exactly.
There's no
absolutely
boxes. It's more just strewn out laundry.
It's a lot more messy and complicated.
Well, the only one who's not lying here is we're out of time. So how do we get hold of you?
So if you for those people who want to attend a university, Costa University, San Marcos was recently stated as one of the best military-friendly schools in the nation. We were the only public school in the state that made that list.
Congratulations.
So, thank you. So if you want to check out Cal State University San Marcos as a veteran, come check us out. We have a great program that is there to support you and help you get to that next level.
Website, phone number.
So go to csusm.edu. You can give me...
CSUSM for San Marcos.
Yes.
CSUSM.edu.
If you have any questions, find me on LinkedIn. I'm like literally the only Moses Maddox in the world.
Hey, he is.
Find me on LinkedIn. Feel free to reach out to me. First of all, you should have a LinkedIn account anyway. So find me on Moses Maddox.
Right.
Find me as Moses Maddox or give me a call at the office 760-750.
So that's the least expectation he has of you. If you're going to contact him, have him a LinkedIn account.
Yeah, I mean,
let's get the phone number again because we stepped on it there.
760-750-7051. If you're a veteran looking for transitional help, I'm here for you.
Okay.
That's awesome, man. I appreciate you being here and driving up, and definitely welcome anytime.
I appreciate it.
We're going to be doing this once a month, specifically on veterans.
And I let this go long, one, because it was interesting, and two, because I know we started a little late, and three, because you did come from a long way, so I want to make sure we gave you as much time as we could.
It's a beautiful drive, though, so...
Yeah. Not complaining about that.
So thanks again, guys, for being here. Appreciate you kicking us off here with the Veterans Hour on the Rad Life, and anybody needs to get hold of us, Rad Life on Facebook, or you can email me at Rod, R-A-A-D, period, G-H-A-N-T-O-U-S, at gmail.com, and we will see you next week.
You have been listening to the Rad Life Radio Show with your host and age explorer, Rad Gontos, brought to you on the one and only OCTalkRadio.net. Join us again next week as we continue our journey of discovery into life's challenges, opportunities, options, and all the latest and greatest things that come with getting older.